to the Resilient Migrant Podcast, a podcast where African immigrants get to talk about their experiences as they assimilate to a different country. This is your host, Brenda Gure. Hi, thank you so much, Mr. Donald Otieno, for joining us today for this podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time. Today we are talking about a worst nightmare for any migrant, things that people don't like talking about. But you really have a wonderful story that I'd like our guests to listen to. So before we start, Mr. Donald Otieno, tell us who you are.
Thank you very much, Brenda. I'm glad to be here, excited. Thank you for allowing me to be part of your podcast this time. I'm Don Otieno. Yes, and I'm glad to be part of this.
Thank you so much. So, Mr. Donald Otieno, this is a podcast for African immigrants. I'd like to know what country you were born in and specifically what location of that country.
All right. I was born in Nairobi, Kenya. Born and raised in Nairobi, Kenya.
Oh, wow. Did you go to school in Nairobi?
Yes, I did. I did go to school in Nairobi, Aga Khan Nursery School. Oh. Went to Westlands Primary School. Then I moved to Ruiru High School for a year, and then transferred over to Senior Chief Koinange High School.
Oh, wow. You went to very interesting schools. And something you and I share that, oh, this is what a coincidence. I went to Aga Khan Nursery School.
Oh, really?
I've never met someone who went to that school. That's so nice to say. Thank you. That's very interesting. Yeah. Wow. So after that, I believe you went to the U.S. So what prompted you to go to the United States?
Growing up, I think I was so excited about the show, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh.
I can tell you there was nothing that drove me to have the desire to go to the States like that show. That guy, Will Smith was my hero. I liked from how he dressed up, how he just looked like he's the guy. Yes, so after my siblings had my older siblings had actually gone to the States to study, I guess now through them I managed to join them there.
Oh wow!
Eventually.
So I need to ask you: did you go to Philadelphia like Fresh Prince?
Apparently not. I ended up going where my siblings were, which was New Jersey.
Okay. Not too far from Philadelphia, though.
right.
That's very, very interesting. So in a nutshell, how would you say your life in the States was? What did you like about the States in general?
All right. I think my life in the States was... I was young. I think I went there. I was 21, 22.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So, of course, my excitement for being there was, wow, here I am, excited to be in the States and on my own and able to do stuff. So I say my life in the States was categorized. It was balanced in the sense that I was able to sort of meet this dream that I had always had.
Yeah.
But in the same time, I was, of course, shocked. By the time I was going there, I was already a Christian, born-again Christian. So I got to see both extremes of life in terms of a Christian life versus the extreme non-Christian life.
Wow.
You know, so that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I usually say that I thank God for an incident that happened that led me to be aware of a Christian organization, a Kenyan Christian organization that was going on. One of my brother's friend's sister was involved in an accident, and we all ended up at the hospital where she was. Mm-hmm. But while at the hospital, it just happens that there were all these Kenyans, Christians who had come to pray. So we were going into the ward in groups because we could not all go in because there were so many Kenyans visiting.
Okay, so Kenyans
yes. So we happened to be allocated in a group where, but the people I was going in with seemed to be these Christians who we went in with, and after visiting, one of the ladies asked me to actually pray.
Oh, okay.
So when I prayed, the lady turned and asked me, "Wow, are you a Christian? Are you born again?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "How come we don't see you at the fellowship?" I said, "What fellowship?" And that's how I got introduced into the Kenya Christian Fellowship in America. Uh-huh. And that's how I began my journey with the Christian Fellowship in America.
Oh, wow. It's very interesting. I didn't know that's how you started. And just to let the guests know, I read your book, When Love Dares. I would like to tell our guests, please, if you can, buy this book. The time I read this book, that's when I understood your journey. I was like, I mean, somebody has to read it to understand it. And I want people to read where you started when you first came, the first place you stopped. I think it was a club, but I'll let the audience read. That was very interesting. And now starting your Christian journey, I knew you from the States years ago, and the way I knew you, you were the vice president of the Kenya Christian Fellowship of America, which is a very big organization of Kenyan Christians in the U.S. that joins all Christians from all the states. So that's how I came to know you, and you did a great, great work. So were there some challenges in your life in the U.S. that you would like to talk about, just anything?
Yes, I think just in general, being an immigrant there's a lot of stuff, you know. We were working and trying to make ends meet, you know, trying to go to school, trying to work more 2-3 jobs, just being a person trying to make ends meet. And I usually say there's the back end of it. Before coming to the States, I was used to seeing Dad. Dad was the provider. He was everything. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm out there on my own. And then I begin to realize, oh, there are bills that Dad used to pay. There was a telephone that I used to pick up anytime. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it had a payment to it. Mm-hmm. You know, there was car insurance. There was things like those I had never even thought of in my life. So, of course, the journey begins, and you're there as a student, and you have to work. That reality checked at first, because I was like, wow. So when you come to think of it, Dad actually used to do all these things, and we never had to, we never really knew about it. So, of course, that was a challenging part of it. But as we moved forward, I got used to the system and how things were running, and I began to pick up. Yes, so it became a new way of trying to become a man and trying to get my way through life.
So I guess your story of Fresh Prince living a good life, enjoying everything, not worrying about anything, was not a reality.
No.
You had to work and go to school. Yes. And I think that is one challenge that we were not ever prepared when we were leaving our home countries. No one told us about working all these double shifts, going to school, paying bills, like you're saying, and then reality hits you. And for you, you said you were very young, you were in your early 20s. No one had ever taught you that. So you have to jump into a different system. That's very, very interesting. I want to ask one question, like I like asking, especially for Black men. Any challenges that you found as a Black migrant man in the U.S.?
I could tell, yes, there was a bit of the racism I experienced at one of my jobs, where It was fortunate. I got a job where I was working with the other white people,
mm-hmm.
and the discrimination was kind of obvious because mm-hmm. you would see that some of my colleagues I was working with mm-hmm. would do certain things
mm-hmm.
and pass with it,
mm-hmm.
whereas when I got to do one or two of those things, it became an issue. I was actually called to the office, questioned, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. asked what, why, how, mm-hmm. when, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I look at it, it was the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. I actually copied from mm-hmm. a white colleague. Yes. So that I got to experience quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember there was one job I was actually asked to leave. That was mm-hmm. the one job I actually was fired
mm-hmm.
ever in my life. But it was a very funny situation because this person was an older person, a colleague,
mm-hmm.
and I questioned why he had asked me a certain thing, why he had asked me about something that he was supposed to be in charge of.
Yes,
and
yes.
when I questioned that, he actually went and talked to the supervisor, and I was not given a warning letter, no question, no nothing. The next thing I know, I was asked to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so mad also because I saw all this coming. So I actually left. I didn't even try to defend myself or ask or question. I actually left.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the one and only job I have ever been fired.
Wow, the experiences of life. And you talked about something that's very interesting that I find with most immigrants. When you come to a system, you don't understand it. Maybe when you looked back, I don't know, but I'm thinking maybe you would have used either professional legal ways to support your case so that you're not fired. But maybe you didn't know that at that time. And obviously, being an immigrant, sometimes you become very fearful. But I'm just thinking that's something maybe you experienced at that time. But there's always the good, bad, and ugly.
Yes, yes, true. Actually, there was one of the jobs where I got into an accident, a very bad road accident.
Mm-hmm.
I was driving the trucks, and I got into a very bad accident. But after that, being the Kenyan man that I am and who needs to work to make a living, I was back at work within the next 2 days.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And I remember being asked, and colleagues actually came and asked me, how, what do you mean you're back to work? I mean, mm-hmm. you should be having neck pains and you should, you know, take this thing, the legal direction, you know,
yes.
claim compensation. And they told me all these things. I remember mm-hmm. one actually even gave me a lawyer's card and mm-hmm. asked me, make sure you call. You can't just come back to work. You should spend like months out there, you
mm-hmm.
know,
wow.
which I found to be weird because I was not actually hurt. So I found it contradicting that I would be this side saying, thank you, God, for saving my life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on the other side, I'm saying, no, I'm hurt. I need to be paid or, you know, stuff like that. So it was such a big contradiction.
Wow. Very, very interesting turn of events and discussions around different issues. Wow. Thank you so much. I just want us to turn your story now to why you left the U.S. Your leaving the U.S. was not voluntary. You were deported. Can you tell us in a nutshell about the circumstance? I know you explained it in the book very well. I was reading the book and you and your wife, Cynthia, were very specific and detailed on the process. And I was like, I could picture you. I could picture how you are. I could picture your fear. So I would really, really like people to read the book. But in a nutshell, can you tell us what led you to you being deported?
Yeah. So now what happened is as I worked, I had overstayed my visa because coming to the U.S., I had been issued a 5-year visa, mm-hmm. and I had, of course, overstayed.
Mm-hmm.
So it got to a point where at work, I had reported to my job in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and the ICE appeared at my workstation. I had come into the workplace and mm-hmm. relieved the person that had worked mm-hmm. through the night.
Mm-hmm.
So they drove in, and I hear the bang on the door, and they show me this piece of paper that says, okay, mm-hmm. you had been asked to leave the country, but you hadn't. So mm-hmm. Here we are to make sure that you're going to leave. So mm-hmm. they grabbed me. Mm-hmm. As I was, you know, searched my pockets, took my wallet, took the few coins I had, everything, and put my watch,
mm-hmm.
put them all in a bag,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was, it was scary. It was like a movie. As it happened, mm-hmm. you know, they were out there.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that the one who had knocked on the door, there were two who had knocked on the door.
Mm-hmm.
I realized later on there were two others that had gone round behind mm-hmm. the building
mm-hmm.
and out on the highway. There was also a police squad car. Mm-hmm. Yes, I wondered, wow, is it, am I such a criminal? But I came later to understand that there are those that try to run away and escape, and there are those mm-hmm. that usually are armed. So mm-hmm. They're actually doing it for their own protection. That's why they come so so armed and ready for anything.
Wow. I don't know how you felt during that moment. Because most immigrants, if there's anything, I know as an immigrant, our fear is being deported. Either you have the papers or not. And I know you mentioned you overstayed. That is just a common thing with most immigrants, because what people don't understand, the system sometimes is very hard to either get your papers the legal way. I know for most people who went to the U.S. as students, they don't find employers to hire them after their education. So what happens, they just want to live their life, work hard, and that's how you end up overstaying. I just want to jump into something that I found very interesting when I read your book. And it's about your identity. Through this process, this is Donald Otieno, the Vice President of Kenyan Fellowship of America. All this identity has been taken. Your identity as a man is being stripped away, even as a human being. And I like a statement. I want to read it. I was stripped down. My frame searched for contraband before being handed new clothes to wear and a new name. The new name was actually a number that would become my new identity. And I was reading that statement. I was like, how your life just changes in a minute. I just want to know how you felt at that time and what you did to just, you know, say, you know what? Let me move on to the, like what was going on around your mind at that time when everything had changed within a minute?
Right. Let me tell you, Brenda, you know, at this point in my life, mm-hmm. I had actually taken quite a long time. You remember, I came into the States as a student,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a young student, you know, interested in buying my Nike shoes and the next latest brand of, you know, mm-hmm. Jordans that appear,
mm-hmm.
you know. So at this point, I had kind of messed my credit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was those guys at that time who used to pay the $5 minimum fee to pay back a credit. I used to pay that exact $5 minimum that they asked for. So it got to a point where my credit had been stretched. It had been stretched. So
mm-hmm.
by this time, when I was actually being taken into detention, I had just acquired and been approved for a house.
Wow.
10 years of living in the States, and finally, I had just gotten the opportunity to buy this house. I had been approved. I had been issued a key. John was actually a homeowner in the U.S. You know, it was it was such an achievement for myself. I felt so nice about this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the night before,
mm-hmm.
I had been to the house and I had just gone to Home Depot and bought the blinds.
Oh, wow.
So this house, I have the key and I have just put in the blinds. Mm-hmm. That was all that I had put in that house, you know.
Yeah.
And the following morning, these guys grabbed me. So
wow.
This is a house I had not moved into. I only had the key, which I don't even know where mm-hmm. what happened,
mm-hmm.
you know. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine as I enter this patrol car and, mm-hmm. and they're taking me into the detention place, mm-hmm. I'm here thinking and wondering, wow, what is all this,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then now while it at the detention,
mm-hmm.
this guy, I remember, yes, I was stripped of my identity, mm-hmm. but I remember being able to make a call to the embassy,
mm-hmm.
the U.S. embassy, and they would allow me
mm-hmm.
to give them a number or a person I need to call, and they would call and I would be connected and we would talk for free.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So my identity as first vice president helped me because there was a lady who was working at the embassy then who knew me.
Oh, the Kenyan embassy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So always connected our calls and mm-hmm. I would be able to talk, you
mm-hmm.
know. So I mean, when in there, when
mm-hmm.
you talk of identity, I mm-hmm. saw all kinds of men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw men, strong men who had been there for a year and
oh,
insisted
wow.
there's
mm-hmm.
nowhere they're going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had decided, hey, we'll hang on in here
mm-hmm.
until these guys let us go.
Mm-hmm.
There were all sorts of men from different backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
different cultures, different religions, different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I, there were times I could see men break down and lose their identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm writing a book that is about to be published. And in that book, I've written now about men.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the spaces where a man is broken completely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would see someone come in when they're visited by their wife,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this is a man who was the sole provider. This is the man who would bring in the bacon
mm-hmm.
and a wife who was a homemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is in detention and the wife comes holding the young
mm-hmm.
children, mm-hmm. you know. They don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely going to be deported. And
mm-hmm.
the tears and I mean, that place could break the strongest of men.
Wow.
So when your identity is ripped and torn out of you, there has to be something that still holds you on.
Wow.
Otherwise, you could break down and just go crazy in there.
Wow. I thank you so much for sharing those very delicate life moments. I'm sure
yeah.
sometimes you relive that and you're like, how did I go through that? And I think I hear you say that some of, and I would like, I'll give you a chance to talk about your book. I hear you say that some of those tough moments in the detention center really opened your eyes to some of the challenges men go through. And who knows,
mm-hmm.
you know? Life has its own way of showing us things that we need to know in a different from a different perspective. Now I want us to move back when you, I know I wish people can take time to read the book because you really explain things from point one to point two, but I want us to jump you getting to Kenya. And there's another section that I really liked that I hear so many people say, when you go back to your home country, there is a sense of belonging. There is a sense of acceptance. No matter how much you've been away from home, there's, I don't know, I can't explain that feeling every time I go back to Kenya myself. There's something that just tells me I'm okay, I'm fine. And I like the way you said it in page 111. It felt good taking the citizen lane. I felt secure. I felt wanted. I felt at home for the first time in 12 years. I had been in the U.S. where I had always considered myself a non-citizen, then suddenly I'm here, home, where I can freely be accepted as a citizen. The fear was gone, and in its place was joy. So can you talk in a nutshell in terms of now you had lost your identity, you come to a country, you still have lost a lot of things. Like you said, you lost your house, you had bought a house, you don't have that anymore, and all the money. And then you had not lived in Kenya for 12 years. And in the book, you also say you really had nothing. Life had changed. But can you talk about that sense of belonging, even with nothing that you had?
Yes. I think while at the detention, I had an option. I remember one of the lawyers telling me, Don, you come from Kenya, right? Kenya has just gone through the post-election violence and you're from the Luo tribe. You know, you can actually ride on this, you know, you can actually ride on this and we can file and petition for you to, you know, get out of here. So my first question to them was, how long will this take?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The lawyer tells me the petition would be 8 months. Within 6 months to a year, depending on for us to get the hearing. Not that the process will be taking that long. It's for us to get the hearing.
Wow.
I looked at that guy and I said, thank you. Mm-hmm. God bless you. Mm-hmm. I don't need that.
Yeah, wow.
You know. Mm-hmm. So I decided there's no way I'm going to sit in that place for 6 months to a year just to find a way to get released, because I'm thinking, what am I doing for all that time?
Yes, yes.
I have a home country where I come from. I think by then, I usually quote that scripture that let peace be your umpire in Proverbs. Mm-hmm. And I realized that every time I try to think of how am I going to work this out, I would struggle. Mm-hmm. But every time I thought I just go home, I felt the peace, you know. So I decided, hey, you know what, let me go.
Okay.
So on leaving, I remember that feeling very well, because even leaving the U.S., when my time reaches, you know, you're known by the number, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. There's no Don Otieno, there's no, you know, Michael or Peter. It is number 37.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And the thing was that you don't get to be told that you're leaving on Friday at 7 p.m. No. Mm-hmm. They can come any time, any second, and remind you, number 37, pack your things, you're leaving.
Wow.
You know? Yes, so that's how I left, and the humiliation I went through, just going through the airport with all the alarms beeping, the metal detectors beating, because I had my handcuffs on.
Wow.
You know, it was so humiliating. It looked like I was a drug lord somewhere, being, you know, and it's just an overstayed visa. Mm-hmm. So I got there, but getting, the flight midway, you know, we were stopping at Amsterdam.
Uh-huh.
My passport was actually given to the pilot who were leaving the U.S. I remember them refusing me to enter the plane until the officers told them, no, he's not a flight risk. It's just a removal and stuff like that. That's when the pilot agreed.
Mm-hmm.
But he had my passport even between the connection of the flight.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking out of the plane and I hear the pilot at the doorway actually say, there he is.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I wondered who. And I found police officers, and the Amsterdam police officers were standing right at the plane, as in they had been already communicated to that there was someone. So even at the new Amsterdam airport, I didn't get to go and sit at the waiting area with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I was put in a room and detained.
Mm-hmm.
And then after leaving that's when I was given my passport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because they knew the next landing is in the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you the refreshing feeling that I had when I landed in Kenya and I saw the sign that says citizen, a non-citizen. I felt so good walking into the citizen line. I felt so nice. My passport was there and I gave him, and the guy, just hearing him speak to me in Swahili, felt so good. He said, "Karibu sana, welcome, you know, your home." Mm-hmm. You know, it felt so refreshing just to feel mm-hmm. that there's home. You know, either way, there's home.
Home is home.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow,
and so, of course, the beginning was hard. I had to go home to my mm-hmm. parents, mm-hmm. my aged parents. And I started off from there.
Wow. And it was a long, long journey you starting. I remember hearing your case through the Kenyan KCFA, Kenya Christian Fellowship in America. And there was a big support system to support you on when you were in Kenya. How did you find the support system of either Kenyans back at home or even in the US in terms of what you were going through?
I say it was interesting for the Kenyans back at home. People had moved on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. As in, I remember it was very interesting to find that, okay, where are my friends? You know, the guys I left college with and stuff like that. As in, people had moved on. People had gotten big jobs and mm-hmm. are working, and they have their families. Mm-hmm. It was so surprising, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of scary and just trying to find out, okay, where is where? Mm-hmm. A lot had changed because mm-hmm. it had been 12 years, never been back home. So, wow. Of course, everywhere has changed. One thing that was so shocking is customer service. Oh, my goodness. I'm still yet to recover from that because it is such a big difference, and just service to the public was different. But I remember the board members of the Kenya Christian Fellowship and members from the Kenyan Christian Fellowship in America. First from the board members, I remember they came together and put some money together and sent my way. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, you know, you could get someone call when they mm-hmm. come. Home, they would call me and ask to meet. Mm. So that kind of gave me a sense of feeling, wow, okay, mm-hmm. you know, it's not all gone, it's mm-hmm. not all dead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, though you know, you go through that, but mm-hmm. you're still wondering, okay, how do I get up? How do I move on? You know, it's mm-hmm. it's not an easy space to be in.
Wow. Great change. I mean, from the States to Kenya, like you say, customer service, I still struggle when I go back home in Kenya and I'm like, Lord, please give me patience. But I'm glad to know some things like the support system from people, and your faith is a big thing that kept you going. Now I want us to switch back to how things started coming back. So you started finding your purpose. You started finding work. I know you got married in Kenya. You now have two children. So talk about some of the things you're doing and how you just started moving on.
All right. So I think after arriving here, I got to see in one of the billboards Kanji Mbogwa. He's one of the guys who's a member of the Zaidia. Not Zaidia Mziki. It was Milele.
Yes.
Milele Music Group. So I saw his on a billboard that he was a worship leader in a church by the name of Mavuno Church, mm-hmm. and it was not far away from where my mom and dad were staying. So I decided, hey, let me go visit this place because I know this guy. I would like mm-hmm. to say hi. You know, I'd seen him do tours in the US and. we were friends. So mm-hmm. I decided to join I decided to visit the church, and I visited, and that's where I actually got connected because mm-hmm. I loved the church. I loved the worship. It was a bit tricky in the beginning because I remember in the US we used to, church was, civilized kind of church. Let me say civilized because now, I it was something new when I saw the Mavuno Church. They were actually doing something very intentional about reaching out to the young unchurched people.
Uh-huh.
So they had, even their worship was all floodlights, music. Whoa. It was like a disco kind of a thing. I mean, even during worship, the dances were in a specific way. And I wondered, this is kind of funny. Actually, I used to lead worship in the U.S., so I'd looked forward to maybe joining and being part of the worship team and stuff like that. But I was like, whoa, this is too much. This is a different level. Uh-huh. But I later came to understand they're actually doing that very intentionally to reach out to those people who don't go to church and those who wouldn't find church their normal setting. So it was a very intentional thing, because I later joined the prayer team. I got to see actually firsthand what the difference that style of worship was making, because people actually visited the prayer tent and accepted Jesus as young people. Uh-huh. So it was an interesting scope. Sorry, I forgot, what direction was I supposed to go? Your question was how I picked up.
So how you picked up and some of the work now that you're doing in terms of the purpose that you found throughout your process.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I was actually online. So actually after joining the church, I found myself, my wife actually relocated back.
Mm-hmm.
We got married. Mm-hmm. So now after getting married, we are here serving.
Mm-hmm.
And we were plugged in into to lead in the NDOA ministry, the premarital counseling. Yes. So we actually attended one because we were supposed to get married. But right after getting married, I remember year one, we were already facilitators. Year one of our marriage, we were already facilitators in the program.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of drove us, and we actually felt, you know, my wife by then got employed.
Mm-hmm.
By the church,
mm-hmm.
and started working there as a children's pastor for mm-hmm. quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, her calling for women and couples was so great that we decided to branch out and start doing something on our own.
Okay.
That's how we started doing premarital counseling and just coaching couples. Mm-hmm. We would find ourselves even in the regular hangouts, we would like to talk to people about, hey, how is your relationship? Mm-hmm. What's working? What's mm-hmm. not working?
Mm-hmm.
So the passion was there in mm-hmm. us, because I remember even in KCFA, in the New Jersey chapter, I used to like to ask people, how are you doing? And the marriage ministry was already there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just needed a bit of starting up. That's how we started.
So for now, you're doing the marriage coaching. I've seen some of the, I'm not married yet, but I've seen some of the marriage flyers out there, and I'm always like, should I just attend this to get some some information? So thank you for talking about that, and I'm sure by the end of this conversation, you will give us maybe some websites we need to visit. I hear and I see you're really doing a lot of work planting a seed in marriages, especially in this generation where marriages are getting a very negative name. And we need to work on that. We need as a society to go back and work on the foundations of marriage. Anything else you would like to talk about the boy child? I have seen on Facebook you doing some things with men. Anything you'd like to talk about that?
Oh, yes. I think now as we started doing the premarital counseling, we noticed that the woman has a lot of support networks around her, right from start. I mean, like when the woman is leaving the parents' house, the support was there. It was big time. And you know, and the parents continue to find out how you're doing, and the cushioning is way softer and mm-hmm. readily available for the girl child.
Mm-hmm.
Then we realized, okay, some of these guys as they come for the premarital counseling mm-hmm. or postmarital issues, when they come for guidance and coaching, you realize, okay, this guy is not a bad guy. Mm-hmm. It's probably what he saw his mm-hmm. dad do, or mm-hmm. it's probably what he knows for, mm-hmm. as the best, because there are things we would say and mm-hmm. you'd find a guy is actually surprised that he's actually doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you could see it that he's actually surprised that what you actually find this wrong, mm-hmm. you know. So that kind of drove me to say, okay, as we do this, this same woman is leaving this coaching session or this counseling, mm-hmm. but going home to a man who is still the same.
That's true.
You know, so that's not helping, because mm-hmm. we are going to end up having you guys come back again, because this is not working. So we decided, okay, as Cynthia works on the ladies, what can we do for the men? Mm-hmm. Because we need 100 mm-hmm. to come into this in this mm-hmm. marriage. So that's what led me to start talking to men separately mm-hmm. and trying to engage them in how we can help them. So that birthed Man Code Events.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
Man Code Events, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Man Code Events is something I came up with, where now we try to engage men mm-hmm. and try and catch hold the hands of men right from marriage. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm trying to introduce the thing of man showers, where as the lady goes for her bridal showers, as the man goes for his bachelor party, it's mm-hmm. not just running to a strip club or mm-hmm. the boys fist pumping you and telling you good stuff and that's mm-hmm. all. But mm-hmm. we're trying to make it more civilized and make it more informative, where mm-hmm. he can actually get to know. Now you are a married man. This is what you're going to go through. This is mm-hmm. what you're going to. Yes, it's not you're expected to know because you're mm-hmm. a man. Mm-hmm. And whereas probably you were even brought up without a father. Mm-hmm. So how are you supposed to know? Mm-hmm. You know, so we're trying to do that. The bachelor parties mm-hmm. in a sane, Christian and informative way. Mm-hmm. We're trying to engage guys to mm-hmm. do baby showers. Mm-hmm. We're trying to invent the man shower.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that the man also is aware that when this baby comes, it's mm-hmm. my baby, and mm-hmm. I have a role to play in this whole concept. Mm-hmm. We're trying to engage them in just doing life, mm-hmm. period. You know, mm-hmm. just have guys around you who can mm-hmm. Walk with you. I'm currently trying to push on the book that I'm doing right now that is mm-hmm. about to come out. Is I'm pushing a lot on the accountability, having 10 to 12 men mm-hmm. who are your accountability partners, and you're just going to walk and do mm-hmm. life together as mm-hmm. men. So yeah, that's what we're trying to push now.
Wow. Thank you for doing such a great work back in Kenya, working with a man. And you talked about some of the things about being conditioned. And that is a struggle we as a society are still fighting. And like you said, if you're a family, it's about, this is my child. And I remember reading in your book, When Love Dares, you talk about an incident where your wife went back to work and you had to remain with your child. And it just became an issue with people around you. They're like, why are you staying with the child? But to you, it's taking care of your baby. And it's very important for you to build that foundation from the word go, even with your child, because now I'm sure your daughter, you're having a very strong bond because they can trust you as a dad and as a man. But I really am grateful to hear about the kind of work you're doing with the boy child. I work in mental health services, and one thing I notice is that we have a lot of the big population that accesses, from my perspective, is men. It's because, again, they don't have the supports. They've been conditioned a certain way. And then by the time they come to seek for the work I do, they're in a crisis, and you realize there's so much they've been conditioned. They don't have any support system. And support system is a very great thing for somebody's mental health. So keep up all the good work. I'll make sure I share your social media handles about the Man Code. Keep up the great work. Your purpose, I see You've gone almost full circle. I know the Lord will open great and mighty paths. Anything in a nutshell, by the as we conclude, come to a conclusion, you'd like to say about the kind of work or your process or anything you feel like you want to say?
Mm-hmm. I'll first just encourage any immigrant out there. I considered my immigration detention experience as the pit. Mm-hmm. But just like Joseph, just like Daniel, these were places that were rock bottom, but did not mean death. They actually got out of these situations to become greater people or even move on in life. It was not a death sentence. So I think sometimes we operate as with fear that what will happen. What will people think of me if I go home now and I have nothing? I came home with nothing. I can tell you, Brenda, I carried a duffel bag.
Wow.
12 years of living in the US, I came home with a duffel bag. I lost everything, everything, which I don't know where they are today. But I can tell you right now, I live in a 3-bedroom house with a wife, two girls, and I am blessed. I can say God has taken care of me. You can rise up again and you can move on in life. It's not the end of the road. And my prayer is that whatever you go through, look at what are you going to learn out of it. What is the lesson to be learned? But most of all, have those people around you who will support you, who will help you. I did not mention, but maybe it's in the book. It's in the Love Dale book, but I didn't mention that Cynthia was there. Wrote me a letter every day of my days, 30 days in detention. Those letters were not love letters. Those letters were letters with scripture, encouragement. She was hearing from the Lord and encouraging me what I needed to hear in that season. Little did I know that this was going to be my wife and life partner. So it is not the end of the road for you. When you are at the bottom of the pit, there is always a second chance. Rise up and walk ahead.
Wow, thank you, thank you. And that is what bouncing back, being resilient means. Thank you for sharing your story. I know most of us don't like talking about deportation. It's like this black word that no one wants to talk about. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much again. So as I end, I want to ask very fun questions. So what was your favorite subject in high school?
Art and craft.
Oh, wow. Do you use it? That explains why you like graphic design then.
Yes. That is my field. That is where I'm stuck. That's what I do to stress relief. I just like to draw. I like to be creative. I like to just do branding and stuff like that.
Oh, wonderful. Nice to know that part about you. Great. So what is your favorite meal?
Oh, chapati. And dengu.
Oh, wow. What do you call dengu in English?
Is it lentils?
It's lentils or mung beans. I see people say mung beans too. There's a difference, but I don't know yet too. So, but okay, got it. When I end some of my conversation, I always have to ask these questions. What are some of the self-care strategies that keeps you going during those difficult moments in life?
One, definitely, just having God. God as a reference. That one, I don't know. I still think back and wonder if I didn't have God and I was in that detention place, what would I do? Because I found solace and comfort in praying or just crying out to God and just reading his word. So that definitely. Wow. Number two, right now, as a family man, I know I have people who are looking up to me. So that keeps me going. That keeps me getting up. That keeps me strong, knowing that I have people who are looking up to me.
Oh, wow. That's great. Always having a support system. And even in the book, just to mention, you mentioned your wife, Cynthia. She wrote her section in the book. So it's good if people read it. Hopefully, maybe in the near future, we'll have her come and talk about what she went through and how she decided to just follow you to Kenya, though you were not married at the time. I mean, you're not married at the time. We'd be glad to hear her side of the story. So one of my fun last question is, you said you are Luo. How do you say thank you in Luo?
You say erokamano.
Erokamano.
Yes.
Erokamano. Good.
Erokamano.
That's erokamano in Luo. What about in Swahili?
Asante sana.
Asante sana. Great to hear that. Thank you so much. So where can people reach you, Donald, your website, your social media handles? And I'll make sure I post them on the links after on this podcast.
All right. My social media Facebook handle is just Don Otieno. That's my Facebook handle. There's the other one for Mancode Events. Mancode Events is my page for the work I do for the men's ministry. And the one we do for couples is Cynthia Wamboi Otieno, Love Life Coach.
Okay. And that's
a Facebook group. Yes, that's where we find a lot of even our posts and stuff on relationships and couples.
Okay. I'll make sure I post all that so that people can get in touch with you and support the work you do. I can't wait to read this book that's coming out or is already out. So thank you so much, Donald. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking the time and continue what you're doing. God bless you.
Thank you so much for having me. God bless you.
Karibu sana.